Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. Adults, if you want to find Psalm, I told you we'd be in Psalms today, the book of Psalms. We're actually going to read from Psalm 22. But before we do that, we're going to read a passage from Matthew 27. I'm on now, Miss Kathy. All right. Great group of kids this morning. All right, so that's Matthew 27. We're going to read that passage first. Then we're going to be in Psalm 22 for the rest of this morning. For the last several weeks, as we've been in the book of John, we've read a lot of the red letters from Jesus, right? I don't know who came up with that idea. I probably should have looked that up because I'm talk about that in just a second. But that's a fabulous concept to put all of Jesus' words in red, I think. If you were to do that, like if you just had a lot of spare time on your hands, thankfully somebody obviously did. And so if you were to take all of the red letters, because we've read a lot. I mean, you think of the words we read from Jesus and Nicodemus, and then Jesus and the Samaritan woman. And even last week, Jesus didn't speak a whole lot, but he spoke some. If you were to take all of those red letter words in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and then, you know, Jesus has a few words in Acts. So if you were to take all of those and put them together, and then you took out what was like duplicate stories, because, you know, some of the gospel stories occur more than once. If you took all of those stories out, you would see that Jesus speaks roughly 31,000 words that are contained within unique stories in the Gospels. And that's almost half, or maybe even slightly over half, of the entire words in all of the Gospels put together. So when you include the black-lettered words, which I thought was fascinating. There's 31,000 words, that different kind of unique stories that Jesus speaks in throughout all of the four Gospels and just right there at the beginning of the book of Acts. However, I would submit to you that what we're going to read from Matthew 27, 45 and 46, and then from Psalm 22 might be just some of the most sobering words that Jesus ever spoke or that occur in the red letters in your Bible and in mine. And so, why? Because it's kind of the convergence of several things. It's the convergence of suffering and pain and tremendous separation, but it's also the convergence of grace and joy, and it's the reason you and I are here today, frankly. And so it kind of, all of those things smash together in what are a very short line, a very short phrase of words, but maybe the most sobering in all of what Jesus says. And so we're going to read those from the lips of Jesus. Then we're going to talk about Psalm 22, and we'll see how those two passages come together this morning. All right, so let's begin reading Matthew 27, 45. Now, from the sixth hour, there was darkness over the land until the ninth hour. So let me kind of stop right there. That's lunch till 3 p.m. So from noon, there was darkness over the land until 3 p.m. All right, that's what the sixth hour and the ninth hour, that's what those were. So now Jesus has already been crucified. He's on the cross at this point, and he was crucified somewhere early in the morning, maybe around 9 a.m., I believe. And so he's been on the cross for a while. And for 3 hours, from noon to 3 p.m., it is completely dark in the middle of the day. All right, now, at the ninth hour, so at the end of the darkness period, so it's already been dark for 3 hours. At the ninth hour, so that's 3 p.m., Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, and this is in Aramaic, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, or in the English, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now that's where we'll stop reading Matthew's gospel. But if you keep on reading, you realize that very shortly after Jesus speaks these words, Jesus dies. And in John's gospel, next Easter season, when we get there, we'll read that Jesus lets out a loud cry and eventually says, into your hands I commit my spirit. It is finished, or it is finished. In your hands I commit my spirit. And Jesus dies. So shortly after Jesus speaks these words, the cross scene is Jesus is dead. And shortly after that, as we'll see at the end of John's gospel when we get there, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea come and ask for Jesus' body. They get it, and he's put in the tomb. And then kind of everybody doesn't know what to do, right? And then 3 days later, as we'll celebrate next Sunday, Jesus rises victorious out of the grave, like the greatest day in the, you know, the history of the world. Literally, quite literally. But today, we want to focus on this statement right here. My God, why have you forsaken me? The interesting thing is that Jesus was not the first person to say these words. David was in Psalm 22, which was a thousand, it's hard to, for me to even have a conception of, 1,000 years roughly before Jesus, David speaks these exact same words. It's hard for me to put that into to conceptualize that, because our experience as Americans is 1600s-ish to today. 1700s, really, things get rolling. So our concept of time is vastly different, I think. 300 years is a drop in the bucket compared to 1,000. But 1,000 years before Jesus even gets on the scene, David, in Psalm 22, speaks these words. And here they are in Psalm 22:1. It's the beginning of the psalm. He starts it off. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's the same thing Jesus says, right? David adds another little sentence in this verse 1. Why are you so far from saving me? From the words of my groaning. Now, we're going to get into the psalm in just a minute. But from the very beginning, and let me just kind of give you a little tip on reading the Psalms. This doesn't apply to every psalm, but a lot of the Psalms, the very opening kind of phrases will tell you or give you a clue as to what the psalm is going to be about or the action that is going to be described in the psalm. So the natural question is, what does this action show? Or what situation does David find himself in? Regardless of what we'll read later, in just a minute, we know by reading just the first verse that something is terribly wrong in David's life. And the main thing, listen to me, the main thing that is wrong in David's life is his, and this is the key word, his perception that God is far away from the reality of his current situation. You get that? We're going to talk about some other problems that David has. But the number one problem that David has is his perception, that's the key word, that God is far away. Why are you so far from saving me? Right? In fact, listen, look what he says, from the words of my groaning. In other words, Lord, I perceive that you are so far from me that you can't even hear me speak. So whatever the situation is, David's perception of the reality of those events is that his number one problem is that God is way away from where he is. He expounds on that in verse number 2. Now, the question that I had after reading verses 1 and 2 is, why did David feel this way? Right? I mean, you think that? I thought that. Why does David say this? What is going on in David's life? Or why is God lingering and saving it? What's going on in the situation? Well, now, if you go through the psalm, you will quickly realize that there is a back and forth between the way David perceives his situation, the reality of what's going on, and where God is in the process. And so that's what we want to look at this morning. What David does is he explains his situation in two key sections, in verses 6 through 8 and then verses 12 through 18. And so we're going to read these because I want you to hear the language. Here's what David says. Remember, David's explaining the reality of a situation and why he feels that God is so far he can't even hear his words. But I am a worm and not a man. Just to stop right there. How bad does your situation have to be for you to think that you are a worm? Like, look, I garden. You may garden. If you don't garden, earthworms are very valuable for helping create quality soil. But let's be honest. The only time you think about the earthworm is when you dig one up or when you see one trying to make it across the hot pavement, right? You're not. When's the last time you thought about an earthworm? Not until I just mentioned it, right? So for David to equate himself as a worm, what is he saying? I am only significant because of my insignificance. In other words, I am lower than low. I'm like the lowest form of entity in the universe right now in this situation. He goes on. Scorned by mankind, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. Here's what the making mouths and the wag their heads. Come on, y'all know what it is. Now, again, if this was the redneck approved version, David would have added a comma, and they're all saying, bless your heart. In parentheses, not in the good way. That's the idea. They're all going around, right? That's what they... Now, in verse 8, look what he says. This is a quote from what the people are saying about him. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. In other words, David says he trusts in the Lord. Well, let God deliver him. Let God rescue him, for he delights in God. Why ain't God delivered you, buddy? You all high and mighty. You trust in the Lord, let him deliver you then. Then, verses 12 through 18, he comes back to this idea of what's going on in his life. He says, many bulls encompass me. We'll talk about that in a minute. Strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouths at me. You know, kind of the little emoji I put in the outline a couple weeks ago. That's what they're doing again. At me. Like a ravening and roaring lion. Right? The picture there is like one standing over a carcass that they've killed. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, like a dry piece of clay. And my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. For dogs encompass me. A company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet. I can count all of my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. All right, now, I want you to hold on just for a minute, okay? Because I know what your mind is doing, because it is what my mind did this week. As I was saying, we're going to immediately read this image, and we're going to run back to Matthew 27, 45 to 46, right? Because clearly, let's just go ahead and say it, there are messianic implications, there are Jesus implications in this psalm. We're going to get to those. But for right now, I want us to look at this passage through the lens of David's situation. So what's going on in David's life? Why does David feel like God's so far away he can't even hear his voice? Because David is in a literal... One commentator says it was a health issue, that David was sick, like on the point of death. It could be that. It could be just another situation that's going on where people are making fun of David, or they're trying to destabilize, that's the word, his kingdom and his rule and his reign. But whatever the situation is, whether it's destabilization of his authority or whether he's literally got a sickness, it doesn't really matter. Because David is in a real situation, a life or death situation, and all the people around him, all the people that are literally in the court of the king, are his officials and his opposition and all of these people that are surrounding him, they are acting as if while he is still alive, he has already dead. So here's the imagery that David pulls up. He says first that there people surround me like strong bulls of Bashan. Now that means nothing to us because we're not from David's Judea, David's Israel, right? We don't live in there. So what does that mean? Well, Bashan was an area kind of on the east side of the Sea of Galilee that was known for growing, known for growing the biggest, heaviest cows, especially their bulls. Their bulls were known to be the biggest of any area around. So what's David saying? The old sickly cows from down there in the desert are around me? Oh, no. The best of the best have got their horns pointed at me. The strongest, the most fit in society, they're looking to gore me with their horns. He says they're like ravenous lions. Have y'all ever watched the National Geographic lions when they eat? These are not, I know some of y'all are cat people. These are not your house cats surrounding David. These are the lions that are the, and some of y'all are like, you don't know my house cat. Anyway, but these are like lions, like hungry lions waiting to rip David apart. He says they are like dogs surrounding him, looking at him as if he is their next meal. Now, I know in 21st century America, dogs are man's best friend. But in David's Palestine and in Jesus' day, dogs were like vermin. They were street walkers who literally were unclean animals who would make you ritually unclean. Dogs were hated. In fact, listen, I watched this show on Netflix. This has nothing to do with, but just to kind of give you the cultural. I watched a show on Netflix that was recently made. In fact, they're like in the third season production right now. And it's an Israeli and a Palestinian show kind of thing. And you know, they kind of go tit for tat with each other. They call each other dogs as a slur because that's how much they still view dogs as like vermin today. So when David says dogs surround me, he's like, not the Labrador sitting beside, you know, waiting for a command. No, these are like street roamer who are waiting to tear in because they hadn't eaten a week. And David says all of this. Now he's using this highly metaphorical language to point us to a literal situation that people are strong, tenacious people are around him. They're already making decisions about what they're going to do with him and his possessions as if he's dead, even though he's still alive. Right? David is so powerless that at the end he said, they divide my garments among them and for my clothing they cast lots. David's not dead. But they're like, well, hey, you know what? If he don't make it, I'm going to take this over here. And if he don't make it, I'm gonna take this over here. And no, you're not. We're gonna fight over that. You know. And David's like, I can hear them all. I'm right here. I ain't dead yet. I'm still in control. I still have the throne. I'm still in power. But they're trying to divide up all his stuff, and he can't do anything about it. So even though David uses this highly descriptive language to describe what's going on, he's got a literal situation where he is threatened around every side. It's like David is up against the wall and everybody's in front of him. There's nowhere to go. And no matter what he does, he can't do anything about the physical nature of his situation. And so David, the reality is he is in desperate need of help. However, remember I said that David, and this is one of the reasons I love this psalm, is because David talks to God, because the psalms are like prayers and sometimes they're songs that you would sing. But I love this psalm because David writes this psalm a lot like I pray or I think. Because in verses 1 and 2, buddy, God is like way over there. But then verse 22-3, he says, yet you. You see that? Yet you. And then in verses, and he kind of carries on this conversation about who God is. But then verses 6 and 8, he's like, but God, you don't know what they're doing to me over here. I know you're far off, but have you seen? They're surrounding me. And then he comes back in verses 9 and following, 9, 10, 11, he says, yet you, but God, I know. And then in 12 through 18, he's back over here. But hey, listen, God, I know you can't hear me, but I'm going to act like you can. And I'm going to talk louder anyway because, I mean, they're like dogs licking their chops waiting to eat me. and that I'm so powerless, I can't even stop them from dividing my assets while I'm still alive. And then in verse 19 or something, he says, but you. And so he prays a lot like I pray, because he goes back and forth between, here's the reality of the situation, but the truth of who God is. The reality of the situation, but the truth of who God is. The reality of the situation, and here's how I feel, and here's what's going on in this descriptive language, but here's who God is. And so throughout this psalm, David goes back and forth with remembering who God is. And he gets two points of how he remembers or what he remembers about God. And the first thing, he remembers God's position. In verse 3, he says, Yet you are holy. And he goes on to describe that God is enthroned in heaven. In other words, God's position is that even though I sense that God is far away and that I am in this wretched position, David remembers that God is enthroned and He is holy and He's still on the throne. So positionally, God is in a position to do something about my situation. But that's not the only thing he remembers about God. David also remembers that God has faithfully rescued people in the past. David talks about how God has rescued, listen to me, how God has rescued his forefathers when they cried out to him. He remembers that God has rescued him in the past. And so now David, when you get to about verse 21, 22, somewhere in there, David is at a crossroads. Just like you and I are at the crossroads in times in our life. Because we're at the crossroads of the reality of our situation and the, listen to me, and the emotions that come around with that, and the truth that God is still God and still on the throne. God has rescued people, and God has in fact rescued us as well in times past. And we're at the crossroads of what are we going to do? Are we going to lean into the emotions and wallow in the pit? Or are we going to trust in God's truth of who He is and what He's done and what He will do? David's at the crossroads in verse 22. And David responds by giving thanks and by committing to share the truth of who God is. And David finishes the better half of the psalm, verses 22 through 31, I believe, give David's response, which David thanks God for speaking into a situation, right? And working the situation out. And eventually, God rescues David from the plight of the reality that he's in. And then David goes on to share about how he will make this known in the congregation of the people. And otherwise, he's going to tell people all that God has done in his life for him from this day forward. And so David ends this psalm not with a woe is me, my God, where are you at? But with God has been right here with me. And I'm going to trust in who God is. And I'm going to see, as the song says, I'm going to see a victory in this situation. And I'm going to trust the truth of who God is and what He's done for me in the past and what I've heard and read about in the Scriptures that He's done for our forefathers in the past. And I'm going to trust in that and I'm going to praise Him and I'm going to pray and I'm going to give thanks and then I'm going to share all that God does for me in this situation. And so where the psalm starts in lament and sorrow, the psalm ends in joy and goodness and a show of God's greatness. All right, and that's the psalm, right? That's the psalm. So now what we've got to do is we've got to say, okay, now that we understand the psalm in the original context which David said it in, we've got to take that back to Matthew 27. So when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? What is he pointing us to? Now, about a year and a half ago maybe, on Wednesdays, we kind of, at some points on Wednesdays during Wednesday Bible study, which if you don't come to Wednesday Bible study and you have time on Wednesdays starting at 11, I would say we get through at 12. Sometimes it's 12:15. Sometimes it's 12:30, depending on how many questions are asked, which are always welcome. We talked about this almond, and Pastor Joe sat right there on the third row. And we were talking about this almond, and he said, hey, I think, and he kind of explained the whole story of how he got to this conclusion. But anyway, what he said was, I think when Jesus was quoting this psalm, when he says this line, my God, why have you forsaken me? He said, I think he's referring to the totality of the psalm, not just the opening line. And I thought, that's an interesting concept. Because I got to thinking, and I thought about it again this week. When does Jesus speak these words? Miss Kathy, can you put Matthew 27:45 back up for us? When does Jesus speak these words? On the cross? Is it when the darkness starts? No. Is it in the middle of the darkness? No. It is at the end of the darkness period. Now, just so you know, this whole dark for 3 hour period, you're like, what's that all about? Were there just clouds in the sky? Oh no. This was a visible symbol for everybody who was at the crucifixion scene and for us today to realize that those 3 hours were when the unfettered, unhindered wrath of God was placed upon Jesus for your sin. It is when, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5:21, He became sin for us. That darkness shows that taking place. The darkness is a visible symbol of Jesus bearing our sins. And in some way, the Father turning His back and separating Himself for Jesus because Jesus was bearing our sin. And so when does Jesus speak the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is it at the beginning? No. Naturally, we would think it occurs in the middle, right? Because in the middle of that period, what would you assume Jesus is feeling? God, you're so far away from me, you can't even hear the words I'm saying, right? Like David said in Psalm 21:1, the second part. But when does Jesus speak these words? At the end of the 3 hours. And what did we say at the beginning of this sermon? This is key. Hope you're listening. What happens right after Jesus speaks these words? He dies. So what is Jesus pointing to? I had always assumed that Jesus was pointing to the separation between Him and God. But when Pastor Joe said, hey, I think he's probably talking about the whole psalm. And might I remind you, who's at the crucifixion scene? The disciples ain't there. But we know the religious leaders are there. Because what do the religious leaders do? He saved others. Let Him save Himself. Kind of sounds like what people were saying to David. What do? Wag their fingers. Make faces. What do the Roman soldiers do? Cast lots for His clothes. Sounds a lot similar to what David's saying, right? Who's there, though? The religious leaders. What do the religious leaders know? They know the entire Old Testament better than you and I probably ever will. So when Jesus quotes Psalm 22, do you think they're just stopping at Psalm 22 in their mind? Oh, no. They know the entire psalm. And so what is Jesus actually pointing us to? The beginning of the psalm or the end of the psalm? I would say He's quoting the first lines so that we read the entire psalm to realize He is, and in my estimation, He is not saying, oh God, you're so far. Oh man. No, because His work is done by this point. It is finished is about to happen. And so what does that mean? That means that Jesus is pointing us as much to the separation as He is to the end of Psalm 22. And what happens at the end of Psalm 22? David realized, oh, God is rescuing me from this situation. And God has given me something to be thankful about and be joyous about and to share with other people. And so when Jesus quotes Psalm 22:1, He's not as much, in my estimation, not as much being, oh, woe is me, and oh. Because if that would have been the case, He would have said it in the middle, because then we'd all have gone, sure. But He says it at the end, right? And I don't think that's coincidence, because he's showing us that all that is gone and all the bad has happened. And even though the people are wagging their fingers and shaking their heads and people are casting lots for his clothes, that he's completed God's work and God's about to rescue him. And that is a cause for celebration and for joy. And I know in your mind you're thinking, but God, rescuing me like dies. Yeah, that's the difference. Jesus' rescue, whereas David's rescue came by his healing, Jesus' rescue comes through his death, and 3 days later, he rises from the dead. Because see, here's the reality. If Jesus just stays dead, while that's a great thing and our sins are forgiven, you and I still have no hope over death, hell, and the grave. And that's why Jesus has to go to the tomb to rise again. We'll talk about that all next week. But anyway, and so again, what is Jesus trying to show us here? Is it the woe is me? We need to be sad. No, he's pointing us to the entirety of the psalm, which ends not in but in joy and jubilation, because God has rescued us. And so the million-dollar question we got to ask ourselves today is, okay, what do I take away from this? Well, I got three things on your outline. I'm going to add another one, and I want to start with the other one. It's not on here, so you take a note. You can like make a little star, put four, and do an arrow, whatever you want to do. Here's one thing. This psalm impacts each and every one of our lives. Because look at me, all of us have at some point felt like David. Right? We've been in the throes of life. Like just the bottom of the barrel of life. And we've at least thought, God, where are you at? I thought you loved me. That person over there is living like hell and you seem to be doing all this stuff. And they're like, what about me? Come on now. Y'all ain't got to look all like. We've all been there. David was in there. And then who else quotes the psalm? Jesus. And so this psalm directly impacts our lives because it shows us that God's people, sometimes it's okay to feel and to go through bad things in life. Like just because you go through bad things in life doesn't mean God's absolutely forsaken you and turn your back on Him. And sometimes God is silent, which is like, there's three answers when you pray, yes, no, and wait a little bit. And we can deal with yes and no. It's that wait a little bit. And when we're crying like, God, hey, I ain't heard you yet. And then you pray that, hey, I ain't heard you yet. And you still pray and it's like, whoo, man, I don't know about all this. Like, and we feel like God, as Elijah said, have you gone on vacation, God? Like, are you at the beach or in the mountains? And that's where, like, point number one in your outline, we've got to weigh our emotions versus truth. And on a very base level, this psalm shows us it's okay to have the emotions. It's okay to feel like the bulls of Bashan are surrounding you. But ultimately, at the end of the day, one of those two things is going to weigh out. You're going to wallow in your emotions, or you're going to trust in the truth. And that psalm shows us, Psalm 22 shows us, it is always, always appropriate for truth to outweigh our emotions. Because emotions take, I don't know about y'all, but emotions take us into bad places that end up with bad consequences that we end up dealing with for a lifetime sometimes. Truth, while it may be hard to swallow, and while it may cause some unintended consequences, always works out for the best. And especially when it comes in to trusting the truth of who God was. Because I bet if you were today to go home and after you eat your dinner, if you were to sit down, you could pen to paper some events where God has in the past rescued you. And it may not be major. It may be small things. But over the totality of our lives, I bet we could come up with untold numbers of ways God has rescued me, and God has answered that prayer, and God has delivered me, which is exactly what David did. And therefore, his truth, the truth of who God was and what he could do, outweighed the emotions of his current situation. All right, so that's one way that applies. It's okay to have the emotion. We're going to have it. We're going to be in, everything's not going to be great in life. We're going to have bad times. But when we get there, you're going to be at the crossroads of truth and emotions, and I'm praying that truth weighs out in your life versus the emotions, right? You got to put them in perspective. Here's the second thing, and probably this is like the whole of the matter. Like if there was one main idea that we had to hang hat on and we could only talk about one, it would be number two on your outline in the thing, and that is that Jesus conquered our sins, and you really should believe in Him. I mean, like, there's only one person in history that's died for the sins of the world and who gives it to you as a free gift. He does not a 10 step, like, hey, you got to do these 10 things, and then maybe if you do them good enough, you make A's on all your tests, and then you'll get it. He doesn't say, hey, if you'll pay me in this much money, then it'll be, no, He just says, hey, all you got to do is trust in me. All you got to do is believe. All you got to do is just say, yes. Turn over your life to me. I mean, why would you not do that, right? The disciples who weren't at the cross, later, after they realized Jesus is rose from the grave, at the beginning of the book of Acts, Peter, again, who was not at the cross, but was transformed by when he saw the empty tomb, he tells a bunch of people in Acts 4, verse 12, he says, there is no, listen to the words, there is salvation in no one else. Now that would have been good enough if he'd have put the period there. But he continues, he says, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Look at me. We can call on anybody and everybody to save us. We can try any and everything, any other product, thing, entity, materialistic gain, whatever we want to call it. But Peter, who walked around with Jesus, who wasn't at the cross scene, but what changed his life was the resurrection of Jesus when he saw the empty tomb, later says, hey, look, there is nobody else you can call upon who can save you. That idea is backed up by what we see in David. David is in the corner. Everybody is surrounding him. And who's the only person he turns to? Who says, if you don't do it, ain't nobody going to. That's God. Jesus came to die on the cross, to be the one, instead of being rescued off the cross, to literally die, be put in the tomb, to eventually rise again 3 days later. Why? So that we could have salvation, so that we could have ultimate deliverance from the one thing that none of us can escape, and that is death, hell, and the grave. But yet Jesus offers us a way to escape that through belief in Him, because He died in our place. And then lastly, how does this apply to us? There's but one response that I think is appropriate, and it's the response that David gives at the end, and that is joy, celebration, and sharing that story with other people. Listen to me. This is kind of amazing. There is no one on earth. You think of how many people are alive today, on 7+ billion people. That's even hard to comprehend. There's no one on earth who has your faith story. Only you. Only you. And while ours may be similar, they are not the same. And somebody needs to hear your faith story, because your faith story will lead them to a changed life through Jesus. So look at me. Don't be scared to share your story. It may be uncomfortable. But hey, look, there's all kind of crazy stuff on the internet. There's all kind of crazy stuff on YouTube. People watch all kind of crazy stuff. They'll listen to your crazy story too. Because what do we all love? Stories. Why do you think Jesus told parables? Because people love stories. People in His day, people in David's day, and your friends at work, and the people you know, and the people you'll come across, they love a story too. And they need to hear your story, because it is about Jesus transforming you, and there's no one else on earth just like you, right? Psalm 22 starts off kind of, ends in joy. Sometimes we're in the same situation. Jesus was in the same situation. And we need to let truth outweigh our emotions and realize that Jesus quoted this verse not so much to give us the woe, but more to give us the joy and the thanksgiving that comes along with it. Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.